know, you've got this guy doing a war whoop in introducing him, the way that he sort of talked about so many different groups, it's not a surprise. And I think that we have to be very clear that Donald Trump is just a symbol for an antiquated, outdated mode of thought that unfortunately still exists and is still very prominent. It was prominent enough to, you know, sometimes we feel like we're picking on Donald Trump, you know, for having these outlandish positions, and we talk about him every single day, and it seems like he's such an easy target. But the truth is that he is running for president. He is the Republican nominee, and so that means there are people who legitimately believe in this man's platform, this hateful nonsense that he espouses.
All right. Jesse Ross, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
So what makes an American? Think about that for a minute. If you say, well, you live in Germany or any of these other countries, you know, what makes you a citizen of those countries? Certainly, being born in those countries would make you a citizen. That's for sure. If you went through the immigration process, whatever country you want to be in, if you went through their immigration process, that seems like something that would make you an American. But we've got something here in America that's unique, that other countries have to a lesser degree, but not quite like we have it. I remember learning in grammar school about the idea of the melting pot, and it sounded like poetry to me. I loved that idea. I grew up in a largely African-American neighborhood, so right away I felt like a minority. And it's not like I was seeking out other white people. Like, well, boy, surrounded by all these black people, I better go find me some white people. I just wanted to see more diversity. And it seemed like I was just dropped in the African-American part of town. What I would learn as I got older, that I wasn't dropped in the African-American part of town. I was dropped in the poor part of town. And I was because my mother had a child when she was too young, and there weren't a lot of resources available to her. And so we ended up in America's economic prison. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 219. My name is Melvin, and I want to thank you so much for being here. As I'm taping today, Hurricane Irma is pounding Florida. And I feel bad for the people of Florida. But I only feel bad for the people of Florida if they heeded the warnings about climate change, about global warming, whatever you want to call it. If they believe in it, and they took steps to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that they create, reduce their impact on the planet, educated their children about the severity of these storms that, yeah, is a thing, is happening because of climate change. I feel bad for those people, but folks like Rick Scott and conservatives who have decided to simply not believe in science, yeah, to hell with you guys. I hope your houses get knocked down. I don't care. Science is a thing that you don't get to believe in. It's real. This isn't like God or the boogeyman. It's a real thing. So I suppose we'll talk a little bit next week about why Florida or the aftermath of Florida getting pounded. It's weird. It's the storms, which are way worse as a result of climate change, are pounding these states that are just full of climate deniers. But I digress. So if you're born in America, or you've lived in America for any significant amount of time, I think that that in and of itself is pretty adequate as far as making you an American. Certainly, if you've respected our laws, and you know, you've got a job, and you're taking care of yourself, I think you've earned your place here. I was born in Butte, Montana, and I have no memories of it because I wasn't there for very long. My mother whisked us away to San Diego, California, when I was very young. So my earliest memories are of first gaining consciousness, you know, as a human being, a little tiny boy in San Diego, California. And for a while, I thought that's where I was born, because that's where all my memories came from. But I wasn't born there, I learned I was born in Butte, Montana. The hell is Butte, Montana? And then I look it up, and it's spelled B-U-T-T-E, and I go, Butte? I was born in Butte, Montana. Little boys, you know, that's the way their minds work. So I think about the DACA program, and I say, what if, and I know it's a terrible analogy, it's not the best, what if I was just thrown into Butte, Montana, right? Not any of these other places I've grown up in, Pennsylvania, Washington, you know, some of these other places that I've lived, Illinois. What if I was just thrown back into Butte, Montana? They go, that's where you were born. That's where you came from. Go back there. Well, I don't have anything there. Well, there's some family, but I'm disconnected from my entire family because they're all a bunch of criminals. And I don't mean that. I mean actual freaking criminals. We're not going to get into it. What if I was just thrown back that you live here because this is where you were born? But this isn't what I know. Live there. That's where you were born. That's where you should go. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Don't throw me into Butte, Montana. I don't know anything about it. I got nothing there. But that's what we're talking about doing with the DACA program. So understand something about DACA. These folks, they, first of all, they're brought here to the country as children. You know, they're not necessarily born here, but they're brought here as children. And then they're raised here. They go to school, they get jobs, any and all the rest. And to be a part of the DACA program, of course, DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. To be a part of the DACA program, you have to be either working or in school. You can't be a freaking criminal. So when Trump gave his speech, when he was running for president, when he was a candidate, about the rapist and all these things that Mexicans are, you're not talking about DACA kids. Actually, I don't think he's talking about Mexicans at all. I think he just hates Mexicans. But he said it. These rapists and terrorists and da-da-da-da-da. You know, rapists and murderers and drug dealers and da-da-da. But you're not talking about DACA kids. Because, see, DACA is an umbrella. It's a protection umbrella. You came here as a child. Your parents brought you here. And they've raised you here. They're not necessarily citizens. You know, you're not a citizen. But this is the only country that you've known. And so we decided that it was going to become a low priority going after these guys. It was going to be a low priority because these guys aren't a threat. Yeah, they're here in America. And yeah, it's technically illegal. But they're not the problem. So let's leave them alone and go after the other guys, the real bad guys. Maybe somebody who's got a connection to El Chapo and not these guys. Because these guys are here. They're as American as the rest of us, and they're doing it right. But this week, Trump decided, nope, we're going to kick those BJ kids out. I remember when the Anne Frank Center decided to tweet about Donald Trump, but a lot of people thought there's no freaking way. Come now. We are not becoming Nazi Germany. You know, there's a dude that lives up the street from me that still has a bumper sticker on his truck about how Obama is a Nazi. And I can promise you that guy just voted for Trump and doesn't think Trump's... It's a weird planet I live on right now. And America's not a country anymore. It's a completely different planet. Because that's the way we've been taught to think about ourselves. We go, American exceptionalism. There's no one else in the world like us. We're the best, right? We've got these flags, these American flags and the Gadsden flags. We whip these things around and this is who we are and we're uniquely and there's no one else in the... But are we? Are we really that great? Are we really that awesome? Do we really have it all figured out? When we're kicking out the law-abiding ones, when we're telling people who are productive members of society, and they're in love, and they want to get married, but they themselves are a couple of dudes, or a couple of ladies. They can't get married, because we've got this book, this 5,000-year-old book, from a Bronze Age god, and they have to believe in it. See, I forget how old the Bible is. I just threw out the 5,000 number. You can't, because this book that we got from a Bronze Age God says you can't because it's icky. Right? You can't get married because smashing clams is not a biblical term. It just, you can't. That's insane that we have that. But that's uniquely American, right? That's one of the things that makes us American. We scream out about how awesome America is. Right? We're doing this sell job. But then we tell people, get the hell out. If you're here illegal, get the hell out. Trump's hiring tons of people at his Mar-a-Lago resort, which, by the way, is going to get pounded today. And if it doesn't get pounded by Irma, it's going to get pounded by Jose. Talk about poetic justice. So we're constantly doing this sell job with America, you know, trying to sell America to people. But then when people are here, we're always telling them to get the hell out. But we're not telling the Europeans to get out. You know, we're not telling, you know, the French and the Germans and the, we're only telling the brown skinned people, because they're the people that look like they don't belong here. So the Anne Frank Center tweeted out about the alarming parallels between America now and pre-Holocaust Germany. And they point out in the list, they said, Trump creates his own media, exploits youth at a rally, endorses police brutality, demonizes people who believe, look, or love differently, strips vulnerable people of their families, jobs, and ability to live, and believes Congress should change its rules to give him more power. They tweeted that out last month. And so much about our elections are cycles. Had Ted Cruz gotten the nomination instead, I think he would have still won. Trump won, but not really, because he lost by 3 million votes. There really was some bad things going on with that particular election. But these things tend to go in cycles. If there's two terms of a Democrat, there's going to be two terms of a Republican. I mean, a lot of it really is cyclical. But would they have been better off with Ted Cruz?
Today, Trump's most serious remaining challenger, Ted Cruz, released his list of foreign policy advisors, and it's a real rogues gallery of warmongers and bigots, including Elliot Abrams, who pleaded guilty to keeping information from Congress about his role in the Iran-Contra scandal, and Michael Ledeen, another Iran-Contra figure and namesake of the so-called Ledeen Doctrine. And I'm quoting directly here, every 10 years or so, the United States needs to pick up some small, crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show the world we mean business. But by far the worst of the bunch, a guy who has no business anywhere near the corridors of power ever, is anti-Muslim conspiracy theorist Frank Gaffney. The man who the Southern Poverty Law Center describes as one of America's most notorious Islamophobes, Gaffney believes the Obama administration and large parts of the U.S. government are fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood, accusing such figures as Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, Hillary Clinton aide Huma Abedin, and Republican anti-tax fanatic Grover Norquist of promoting Sharia law. Gaffney's organization, the Center for Security Policy, is responsible for the bogus poll cited by Donald Trump himself in justifying his proposal to ban Muslims from entering the U.S., an idea that now appears to have gone mainstream in the Republican electorate. According to exit polls, around two-thirds of the voters in this past Tuesday's Republican primaries said they support banning Muslims from the country.
Is there anybody of any value in that party anymore? No. I mean the Republican Party. And I don't mean the voters themselves. I believe that the Republican voters, and I honestly believe this, that there are a lot of good people with good hearts who honestly just want the same thing that I want. But they choose to get their messages from the wrong kind of messengers. They tend to get them from these shysters, these salesmen that are just mouthpieces for the captains of industry who don't really have their best interest at heart. I believe a lot of conservatives, and I know because I've got to meet some, when we talk about anything, now if I talk about anything with a conservative, music or movies or really anything, even sometimes compassion, I can find some good common ground with conservatives. But talk about climate change. That's where it goes sideways. That's where you can almost see the top of their head blowing off. Liberal conspiracy! It ain't real! And it's not because they're a scientist. It's because those are the people that they're listening to. And I go, okay, how about the welfare program? Those dang gum lazy N-bombs are... No. And they believe all these things that are not true if the position that they hold is conducive to what the billionaires want, the millionaires want. They seem to hold these positions for people that they are not like and that they are never going to be like. And the idea that's been perpetuated by a lot of conservative media is that they are merely temporarily embarrassed millionaires. So they're getting their messages from the wrong place. They should probably listen to this show because, hey, conservatives, you are welcome. Yeah, I'm not going to back down from the whole, if you voted for Trump, you're either a white supremacist or you're an outsider. You can't back somebody like that. Say, I'm not a white supremacist. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Or at the very least, you voted for one. I think it's pretty clear, though, with respect to the leadership of that party, there are no good people in the leadership of that party.
No, no, don't worry about it, guys. Okay, let me finish. Let me. How about these guys don't need to go? Let me finish. No. You can stay there. Let me. Hold on a second. So, you know, I respect the passion of these young people because they feel deeply about the concerns for their families. Now, what you need to know when I'm speaking as President of the United States and I come to this community is that if, in fact, I could solve all these problems without passing laws in Congress, then I would do so. But we're also a nation of laws. That's part of our tradition. And so the easy way out is to try to yell and pretend like I can do something by violating our laws. And what I'm proposing is the harder path, which is to use our democratic processes to achieve the same goal that you want to achieve. But it won't be as easy as just shouting. It requires us lobbying and getting it done. So for those of you who are committed to getting this done, I am going to march with you and fight with you every step of the way to make sure that we are welcoming every striving, hardworking immigrant who sees America the same way we do, as a country where no matter who you are or what you look like or where you come from, you can make it if you try. And if you're serious about making that happen, then I'm ready to work with you.
Wow, when we had an adult as president. I mean, we had an adult as president last year, but it seems like a lifetime ago now. So that's how President Obama was treated on the immigration issue. And to be fair, President Obama did deport a lot of people. He deported more than the Bush administration. It was a serious thing for him. But on the DACA issue, he was pretty clear. It's so weird because I'd watch Fox or I'd listen to Alex Jones or any of these guys and they'd be screaming about how he's just flown open the doors, letting in all the Mexicans and Jews and all the rest that they just hate them all. God dang it. He never did that. He was called derisively the deporter in chief. Because he really did boot out a lot of people that weren't following the laws and, you know, they didn't have good immigration status. But on the kids, he said, hey, you know, if they came here not under their own will, they've been raised here as Americans and they're doing the right thing, then we're going to protect them. And he says, so give us your information. Let us know who you are. Let us know where you are. Go ahead and come out of the shadows. And we will take care of you. We'll look out for you. We'll help you along in the immigration process and any and all the rest. And now, and those kids did, millions of them, came out of the shadows and said, here I am, count me as an American, or at least someone who is on my way to being an American. Ladies and gentlemen, I've got brown skin, not dark brown, but I'm definitely not European, not just European. You know, I'm lightened up by I've got Irish and I've got Native American. But the thing that makes me American to Trump and a lot of his supporters is the fact that I've got white skin. Yeah, I was born here, but I don't know. I'm fairly dark. Maybe I should be thrown out too. Anyway, I'm just bitching. So we're taking that information that these kids willingly handed over because they wanted to follow the law. And they really wanted to be Americans. They really wanted to be a part of the country that they love. They came out of the shadows. They handed their information over. They're doing everything right. They're following the laws. And then Trump says, oh, this is the exact information that we are going to use against you. Let me point out some things about the DACA program. And I know that this is a topic of conversation in major media. And generally, if something is a topic of conversation in major media, I won't cover any part of it. But the DACA thing, it hurts my heart and I have to get it out. So, quoting here from Newsweek, there are more than 43 million immigrants in the U.S., according to the Migration Policy Institute, or about 11 million of them are undocumented immigrants. An estimated 22% of undocumented immigrants are under age 25, this according to the Department of Homeland Security. The Migration Policy Institute said in 2016 about 1.9 million people were eligible for DACA. 1.9 million. About 788,000 have had their request for DACA status accepted, according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. In order to apply for DACA, immigrants had to be younger than 31 on June 15, 2012. They must have come to the U.S. before turning 16. They must have lived in the U.S. since June 15, 2007. In a Center for American Progress survey, roughly 3,000 DACA recipients, 9/10 of the respondents said that they had jobs. The average hourly wage for these kids that is working is $17.46 an hour, up from $10.29 before receiving DACA. So as Americans, you know, or at least being seen as equal in the eyes, they began earning more money, a more livable wage. About 72% of respondents were in higher education. After getting DACA, nearly 80% of respondents said they got driver's licenses, and about half of them became organ donors. And they didn't say, make sure to only give my organs to brown people. They said, I'm an organ donor. I'm an American. And I want to help. If I die, I would like to still help out. A morning consult poll from April found that 56% of registered voters said Dreamers, another name for DACA kids, should be allowed to stay and become citizens if they meet certain requirements. The Center for American Progress estimated that the U.S. would lose about $460 billion in GDP over the next 10 years without DACA, and about 700,000 could lose their jobs. More than 1,800 governors, attorneys general, mayors, state representatives, judges, police chiefs, and other leaders have signed on to a letter supporting Dreamers and DACA recipients. So the Dreamers are doing it right. More right than a lot of folks, actually. So why is this happening? Why is Donald Trump doing this? Donald Trump is failing as a president, as a human being, and as a member of the human race. And the only constituency that he has left is these white supremacists. He calls them very fine people. He says they too have legitimate concerns. He uses their exact talking points all the time. We'll get into that in a little bit. And since that is a constituency that is pretty significant, it's not enough to win an election, but that, along with a few other morons, and yeah, he could win re-election, I think. Of course, he's got to make it there first, and some of these investigations against him are looking pretty terrible. But that's the only constituency that he has left. So he's going to continue to do things in order to shore up that constituency. So, it's not enough to just bitch about things. What can we do? Because Trump said, okay, Congress has 6 months to fix this. Translation, get the F out, brown people. Because he knows Congress, good night. Okay, all right. Let's imagine everyone in Congress wears shoes, the kind of shoes, the tie. Okay, I know they wear shoes, but the kind of shoes, the tie. And let's say, you know, they put the shoes on, they start walking, they step on the laces, they fall flat on their faces. Holy crap, I stepped on my laces, what should I do? Guys, what should we do since we have put on our shoes and we are all falling flat on our faces? We should tie our shoes. I promise you there'd be people in Congress that would say, no, absolutely not. I am anti-shoe tying. But if we do this, we'll stop falling flat on our faces. No. I've got this lobby and that lobby and that. No. There would be a vigorous debate. And what would come out of that debate is absolutely nothing. Nobody would tie their freaking shoes and they'd continue to fall flat on their faces until there were no teeth left in the front of their mouths. They can't agree on anything. If they step outside and the sun is shining, they would disagree about whether or not the freaking sun is shining. They can't do anything. The conservatives are in charge. So you see where I'm going with this. So since they're not going to do anything because they're conservative and they can't even agree on the conservative agenda, there are things that we can do. First of all, call your representatives. Tell them to support DACA. Now, tell them to not, I mean, and you've got two senators, member of the House of Representatives, right? You can find out who that is pretty easily. You know, go on congress.gov, you know, or house.gov. Find out who your representative is pretty quickly just by plugging in your zip code, okay? Call them. Tell them to support the DACA program and tell them not to agree to kick out all these kids. Donate to United We Dream. United We Dream, this according to Bustle.com, is the largest immigrant-led youth organization in the country. They organize and advocate for all immigrants, regardless of whether or not they're here legally. United We Dream was an integral part of the initial success of DACA and will no doubt be on the front lines of fighting Trump's rollback. Share the facts and figures about this program with anybody that will listen. Those points that I just read from that Newsweek article, which are pretty easy to look up. It's 15 things you should know about DACA. Look that up. Show that to your friends and family. Yeah, there's going to be screams about fake news because it's good, because it's a real story. It's truth and it's believable and it's about brown people. But you should still share it. Because for the ones that will listen, for the ones that still believe in facts, you can get them on your side. Donate to the Young Center for Immigration Rights. Young, undocumented children are at high risk for all manner of abuse. The Young Center for Immigration Children's Rights works with immigrant children to ensure they are safe and that their wishes for where to live are honored. Push other states to follow the example of California and Texas. Both California and Texas offer in-state tuition at their public colleges to undocumented immigrants. It's a small step, but it's one that can have a big ripple effect over time. Sanctuary cities. When they talk about sanctuary cities, this is where local law enforcement in your state, in your municipality, has said that they're not going to get involved in immigration issues. They call them sanctuary cities. They said, feds, you can go after immigration issues all you want, but we're not going to donate local resources to this. And conservatives hate that. They think your local police force should not be fighting crime, but should be on the lookout for brown people. So whenever you hear somebody call, sanctuary cities, what they're saying is they would really like to live in a police state and have a police department that's motivated more by race than law enforcement. Donate to the National Immigration Law Center. Hashtag here to stay. Donate to them. They work on behalf of undocumented immigrants who can't afford to pay for their legal representation. Show up at a march and at the ballot box. Yeah, there's going to be a white supremacist there. And they're going to try to drive over us and kill us with their cars. But you can kill the protester. But you can't kill the protest and you can't kill an idea. Donate to the Immigration Defense Project. They offer an array of services to immigrants who need help, primarily in the courtroom. Volunteer your time and your language skills. For those who are fluent in a second language, your skills are in demand. Volunteer with the National Immigration Justice Center as an interpreter. For those with a background in law, pro bono opportunities are also an option. So this article is called How to Help Dreamers Fight Trump's DACA Decision with Your Time, Wallet, and Voice. It's by Jessica Lahetu over at Bustle.com. If you Google it, it should be real easy to find.
Well, first, I would even challenge the premise, which is that, and his claim that he's getting bad publicity, that doesn't certainly seem to be the case. If you measure it out, he's gotten about $2 billion, $2 billion worth of free airtime. That's, 10 times more than the next best Republican rival, has gotten in free or sort of earned media. So on balance, he's sort of dominating the airwaves there. But there's another element to it, which is that if you look at the substance of of those interviews, it's not that he's going into these interviews and he's being, challenged with facts. And aggressive sort of journalism and questions. Reporters are afraid that Donald Trump will shut him out. And so on balance, when he goes in there, they're very soft interviews. There's a hesitation to actually force Donald Trump to confront facts. It's typically, the discussions and the subject matter is exactly what he wants it to be about. Now, on the surface, it might seem like a controversy, but it's a controversy that he created, which means he understands its benefit to him, his campaign, and where he needs to go with that controversy in order to maximize the benefits from it.
Trump hates the media because they point out things about him that are true that he does not like having pointed out. But by and large, they're still pretty gentle with him. If he does anything, even the teeny tiniest little thing, the media starts falling all over themselves going, "Oh, he's so presidential. Oh, look, he's here so good." So now that he's standing up and speaking out and saying, "Hey, Florida, Texas, federal government's got your back. We're going to be there for you. We're going to help you. Federal government's da-da-da-da-da." Now that he's doing stuff like that, they've completely forgotten about the fact that he called Nazis good people and said that they've got legitimate concerns and used their exact talking points. It's so insane. But they so badly want to fall all over themselves for him. And so it's no surprise when stories like this don't get reported. So this by Max Greenwood over at The Hill, quoting here, "Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida filed requests with the government for 70 temporary foreign workers. He's done this several times since he's been president, such as cooks, housekeepers, and servers at the private club, this according to the Labor Department. The jobs would begin next month and end in May 2018, so next month would be October 2017. Those positions would take advantage of the H-2B visa program, which allows U.S. employers to bring foreign nations to the country for temporary non-agricultural work. The Trump National Golf Course in Jupiter, Florida also filed a request to hire foreign temporary workers and cooks for about the same time. The request came as the White House celebrates what it designated as Made in America Week, highlighting American-made products and re-upping the administration's emphasis on bringing jobs back to the U.S. Employers must establish that there are not enough workers in the U.S. able or willing to fill the temporary positions in order to qualify for the H-2B classifications. So, here's what Trump did, because he's, "I can't find an American, need me some foreign workers." So they take out an ad in a paper, and it's a very small ad, and it's not real clear, and it doesn't have the logo for Mar-a-Lago or any of that stuff. It's very, very tiny. It says, "We're hiring," and they put in the paper, and they have it tucked into a corner somewhere in the paper where it's completely inconspicuous. And they run it for a couple of weeks, and they hope to God no one answers it. And then when nobody answers the ad, they go to the Labor Department. They go, "Hey, we can't find any Americans to do this job. Look, we put an ad in the paper and everything. Big, tiny, glowing ad, not glowing, that says Trump is hiring and we can't find anybody." So he puts in this request to get him some foreign workers. So does this mean that you're going to go to the Trump resort and you're going to see brown people everywhere? No, it doesn't. Although you might see a few, he's still trying to hire largely white people because that's who he is and that's where he's at. The positions at both Mar-a-Lago and the golf course pay $13.34 an hour, according to the filings. The server jobs pay $11.88 an hour, while the housekeeping positions pay $10.33 an hour. Trump has defended the hiring of foreign workers at Mar-a-Lago, saying in an appearance on MSNBC's Morning Joe about a year ago, that getting help in Palm Beach during the season is almost impossible. Well, sure, if you take out one of those teeny tiny little thumb ads.
He sort of understands the modern media environment that we're living in. And it applies in multiple ways. On the one hand, he utilized the conservative media apparatus. There's a very strong and deep conservative media infrastructure in the United States. And ever since President Obama was inaugurated, they have sort of, and they've been doing this for a while, but they really fomented an animosity, a rage. And it was fueled in part by an ideological elements and in part by racial antipathy. And when Donald Trump, you know, first really kicked off his campaign, he sort of channeled and harnessed some of that racial antipathy right out of the gate when he said that Mexican immigrants were rapists and murderers. That is a smear that had been percolating in conservative media for a while. That's an example of his manipulation. Another example of his manipulation is we saw it tonight. He claims he's going to do a press conference. Everybody treats it and pretends as though it's going to be a press conference. I mean, starting earlier this morning, all of the cable networks were promoting the idea, not that it was just the election returns tonight, but that Donald Trump was going to be taking questions live. And as a result, they have more reporters there. They send some of their best people and their most high-profile people. They give it a lot of promotion and attention. Everybody's tuning in, and boop, he doesn't do any questions.
Allow me to be crystal clear. We have net negative immigration. And it's not just Trump. We have net negative immigration. That means there are more people leaving than there are coming in. Net negative immigration.
What you're really worried about is immigration coming from Mexico. You should want them to do well economically. Over the last few years, more Mexicans have left than have come in.
Right.
So this is working. So why do you want to change it? Plus, if you really do want to renegotiate, Bill, this is not exactly a way to get the Mexicans to show more flexibility. He wouldn't come here. Why do we think he's going to compromise?
So when folks come here from the South, by the way, we have more people that come in from the northern border than the southern border. I pointed this out before. But those, they're coming from a white country. So that's okay. And by the way, this isn't really something that Trump cares about. But what's the real solution? Let's say there's these marauding bands of brown people coming in, getting our white girls pregnant, selling drugs to our kids, raping other white girls, so on and so forth. Let's say they're coming here and they're doing these terrible, no good, awful, very bad things to exist in a society. I don't want to say that because there are lots of homeless people. But if you want to be a part of a society, you got to, at least to some degree, follow that society's laws and rules and economics and all the rest. So you have to have money. Unless you want to sleep on the street and push a shopping cart, you have to have money. How are you going to get that money? Well, you have some sort of job, whether that be employment from a construction company or a restaurant or you're a drug dealer, fine. Generally, you got to make fairly good connections to become a drug dealer. Don't just get to show up and you're a drug dealer. No, you kind of got to be a part of the community in which you're dealing drugs, because there's this whole unspoken thing. You know, you don't get to just set up your marijuana stand on the corner. I guess marijuana is legal now. Your coke or your meth stand on the corner with the sign. This is, you know, fresh meth, you know, blah, blah, blah. Come do your hits here. No, you can't be that open about it. So you got a money and you need a job in order to get that money. So how do these folks come here in the face of, say, the recession? If immigrants are coming here for work and they're escaping the hell that is their country, what makes them come here? So the headline, many illegal immigrants have jobs in the U.S. before crossing the border. This from the Associated Press. When Pedro Lopez Vasquez crossed illegally into the United States, he was not heading north looking for a job. He already had one. His future employer even paid $1,000 for a smuggler to help Vasquez make his way from the central Mexican city of Pueblo to Aspen, Colorado. "We're going to Colorado to work in carpentry," he said. "We have a friend who is going to give us a job," Vasquez said. His story is not unusual. A growing number of U.S. employers and immigrants are tapping into an underground employment network that matches one with the other, often before the migrants even leave home. It continues to become clear who controls the immigration. It's not governments, but rather the market. This according to Jose Santibanez, director of the Tijuana-based think tank Colegio del Frente Norte. As debate over the immigration heats up in the United States, more and more U.S. companies in need of cheap labor are turning to undocumented employees to recruit friends and relatives back home and to smugglers to find job seekers. Darcy Tromenhauser at the nonprofit law project Nebraska Appleseed said companies in need of workers rely on networks to pass along the information more effectively than billboards. It started out more explicitly, where meatpacking companies used to have buses to transport people to come up and would advertise directly in Mexico. Now, I think it happens more informally. At the same time, it has become less risky for companies to recruit illegal immigrants. Since the September 11th terror attacks, U.S. prosecution of employers who hire such workers has dwindled to a trickle as the U.S. government puts its resources more towards national security. The few cases that are prosecuted, however, highlight how lucrative a business recruiting undocumented workers has become. In one case, a single smuggler allegedly earned $900,000 over 15 months, placing 6,000 immigrants at jobs at Chinese restaurants across the upper Midwest. Shanwei Yu, a 51-year-old Chinese-American who was sentenced to 9 years in federal prison on charges involving the transportation of 40 of those immigrants, investigations involving the others continue. Rich Hilzendager, special agent for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Grand Forks, North Dakota, said Yu connected 6,000 migrants from Latin America with jobs in Chinese restaurants in Illinois, Michigan, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. Based in Yu's home in McKinney, Texas, the Great Texas Employment Agency placed ads in Chinese newspapers in the Chicago area offering cheap labor from Latin America. The employers housed in cramped apartments provided by employers. They worked 14-hour days, little outside contact. And the case broke that this is what was happening, that they're made to work these long hours and live in these little tiny places. In August 2004, after two Mexican migrants working at the buffet house in Grand Forks fled poor conditions and were picked up along a highway by Border Patrol agents. So, they generally have jobs even before they come here. And I see this. I see this because I work in the construction industry. I will go to job sites all the time. And I will see if it is a non-union site. Non-union is the important word there. The vast majority of the guys that will be working on the site will be Latin, will be Mexican. And I go, so is there such is it a cultural thing? Like there's this in Mexico, everybody's just born knowing how to build. And they're all just great at that. And it's the only thing that they're, you know, most of them are able to do. How are there so many Mexicans on these particular jobs? It's interesting. You notice these things, and then you realize what it is. By and large, it's exploitation. So these employers, who, by the way, I can promise you, tons of them, tons of these employers align economically with Donald Trump, and very likely supported Donald Trump for president, and were probably at his rallies alongside all the other white people screaming about, we need to get these Mexicans out of here. So I can't even pretend to be as racist as some of these guys are. And yet, they're participating in the underground network to get those workers here. And then once they're here, it goes like this. You are going to work for some measly wage. $5 an hour. $4 an hour. A bowl of rice a day. That's what you're going to work for. You're going to give me 14 hours a day of work. You're not going to have leisure time. You're not going to hang out with your family or your friends. You're not going to have disposable income. You're not going to see the city. You're not going to go out and enjoy the nightlife. You're going to live a horribly miserable existence because you're going to work nonstop. You're going to work your fingers to the bone for my company. And in exchange, you get to be in America, the greatest country in the world. American exceptionalism. You get to wave an American flag. Well, I guess you can do it in your room while you're sleeping, because you're not going to have any other time than that. You get to be in America and say you're an American. And maybe someday you'll get to have the American dream. And I, your crooked ass employer, will not call ICE and have you hauled the F out of here. How's that sound? You work yourself to death, and I don't turn you in. I get all the benefits, and you get effed. How does that sound?
Trump's comments, they were shocking for a number of reasons. The first one being is that, hello, are you serious, Mr. Trump? Who helped you build all your Trump towers? Immigrantes, immigrants. Apparently, Trump enjoyed the discounted labor. But as soon as it was all said and done, he decided to turn his back on the very people who did the construction work. You know, the people that do all the heavy lifting. Trump may need a quick history lesson. Give me your tired. Give me your poor. The United States is a nation that was built off the back of immigrants. So when he generalizes that Mexico is sending people here who are criminal rapists, or are carrying diseases, not only is he absolutely wrong, but he's forgetting that the U.S. and these people from all parts of the world are seeking a better life for their family. The second reason it was a little shocking is that the GOP has been rumored to be in reform mode for this specific presidential race. They want to learn from the mistakes from the Romney campaign, and Trump running and making continuous outlandish comments may work out in the other GOP nominees' favor. Jeb, Marco, Rand. They have the awesome opportunity to refute these comments that Trump is making and present themselves as having a reform approach to the way the GOP views immigrants. Will it happen? Time will tell.
And what happened? Time has told, and we picked the racist. The guy that said all the racist things, we picked that guy, the racist. We picked the racist to be president. So I think it's pretty clear where the real problem is with immigration. And it is not illegal people. Nobody is illegal. Yeah, you broke the law to come to America. But it sounds like in a lot of these cases, according to that American, the Associated Press story, that they are being invited here. They are being smuggled here. And only once they're here are people beginning to scream, including their employers, about how we are being overrun by immigrants. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer problem. But then there's the other thing. Those employers are rich. They're also largely white. And since September 11th has happened, our government has decided not to put resources into going after those people because we're concerned more about national security. And so a lot of those employers are hiring with absolute impunity. And then there's, of course, the temperature of the country right now. The Birth of the Nation, Birth of a Nation is a movie that paints the Klan in a very bright white light. And I mean that. And it turned 100 years old about 2 years ago. And it's still a relevant movie. More relevant than ever now, since the Klan is also enjoying a resurgence in the streets of America. I engage every so often in online discussions. And it takes very little time before somebody begins screaming, like all caps pounding on their keyboard, about Antifa. We have Nazis. And I'm not calling them that because they look like maybe kind of sort of Nazis marching in the street. But the concern for conservatives is the anti-Nazi people. This is a real thing. So, quoting here from Time Magazine, D.W. Griffith made The Birth of a Nation, and at the time claimed to be filming history. The Birth of a Nation, which was based on the novel The Klansman by Thomas Dixon, features a stunning revision of Reconstruction. While the actors in blackface, portray members of a barbaric sex-crazed militia of freed men that terrorizes and disenfranchises cowering whites. Black men overtake South Carolina's judicial system and legislature, swigging whiskey, eating fried chicken on the floor of the state house, and after the blackface character Gus attempts to rape a white woman, the protagonists don their hoods and apprehend him, lynching him after their version of a fair trial. The film is ostensibly about white national reconciliation at the expense of emancipated black Americans. A title card punctuates the action toward the end of the film to declare the former enemies of the North and South are united in defense of their Aryan birthright. Despite its objectionable content, the film remains an essential part of the discussion about American cinema because of Griffith's pioneering technical innovations. Things today are completely taken for granted, like close-ups, fade-outs, and even varying camera angles. But all of these things originated with The Birth of a Nation. And dig this. Woodrow Wilson had famously a screening of the movie at the White House. This from The Guardian by Ashley Clark. As a telling signifier of cinema's cultural impact, even in its earlier days, The Birth of a Nation prompted a huge upsurge in Ku Klux Klan membership. It was used as an effective recruitment tool up until the 70s when then-leader David Duke would screen it in meetings and add his own narration. It also boasts the dubious distinction of the first ever film to be screened at the White House. President Woodrow Wilson, who had famously a poor record on race, enthusiastically endorsed it. He is quoted as saying of the film, "It's like writing history with lightning, and my only regret is that it's so terribly true." The headline, Donald Trump is operating straight from the white supremacist playbook. Meet Derek Black. The New York Times Daily podcast featured an interview last week with a fellow named Derek Black. He was suckled from childhood on white supremacy and even helped create a children's page on Stormfront, his father's website, which is variously described as white nationalist, white supremacist, or neo-Nazi. His grandfather was David Duke, probably the most famous Ku Klux Klansman in the United States. Black spent his youth attending rallies and learning how to proselytize, and generally bathing in the notion that the only way to make America great again would be to purge it of non-white races. In any case, the arc of the interview was eventually Derek Black went off to college and out of state and found himself contending with educated people who would systematically shred the studies and pseudoscience that Black cited in support of his beliefs. For example, there are IQ differences between races. He started learning that all this stuff that he was helping promote wasn't necessarily true. In short, Black himself received a humiliating education. And he decided that white supremacy was a fringe movement for ignorant, angry people and publicly abandoned it. And in return, his family abandoned him. It was much more than a feel-good, I-have-seen-the-light interview. Black explained the white supremacists' movement recruiting strategy, which he said necessarily involved some self-concealment. We told people all the white nationalist talking points without necessarily saying that they're white nationalist talking points. He's talking about his time as promoting white nationalism. My whole talk was the fact that you could run as a Republican and say things like, we need to shut down immigration, we need to fight affirmative action, we need to end globalism, right? These are the talking points. And you can win with these positions as long as you don't get outed as a white nationalist. Sound familiar? The plain fact is that America now has a president which operates straight from the white supremacist playbook. At the very least, Donald Trump and his most rabid followers have been objective allies of the white supremacist movement, even if they thought they weren't. Vladimir Lenin would have called them useful idiots. Think about Charlottesville. The whole Charlottesville thing, they said, happened because of this statue. Charlottesville had already named the space in which the statue stands from Lee Park for Robert E. Lee to Emancipation Park. And white supremacists saw their rally as an opportunity to recruit under the guise of protecting our history and culture. Black said he expected the usual denunciation by politicians of both from both parties at just about every level because everybody knows it's extremely easy to condemn a white nationalist rally. Put it another way, it's a moral imperative. And indeed, the condemnations flowed freely August 12th, the Saturday after the rally took place, with one prominent exception, President Donald Trump. The fact that he would not immediately denounce the marchers, though he read a boilerplate repudiation from a teleprompter, Black said it was weird and was taken as somewhat of a victory by his racist former fellow travelers, some of whom had shouted Hail Trump at the rally. Then came Trump's news conference on Tuesday, August 15th, when he said that some of the marchers in the white nationalist rally were very fine people. Ask yourself this. How in heaven's name do fine people find themselves among torch-waving men shouting about non-white minorities and blood and soil? And why would a fine person not bolt at the first chance of Jews will not replace us? Are there really fine people in that crowd? Trump then said you had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down, to them, of a very, very important statue and the renaming of the park from Robert E. Lee to another name. Now look at those last three words, to another name. Donald Trump, President of the United States, not only thought that there were very fine people among the white nationalist marchers, but he refused to say Emancipation Park. Derek Black was listening in a coffee shop and said that Trump's words took my breath away. The president had, in his view, validated the white supremacist messaging strategy in a stroke. When he heard, he said, what they heard, he said, was Donald Trump thinks we're fine. All the people who just needed a little extra nudge to be told their son would be denied university because of affirmative action or that an immigrant would take their jobs, now they just had to be nudged. Black called it the most important moment in the history of modern white nationalist movement. David Duke and other white supremacists rejoiced, and they've crawled out from under the rocks that they have been basking in with their president's complicity.
Today, January 25th, 2017, is the darkest day in immigration history in America since the internment of the Japanese Americans during the Second World War. Mr. President, I have a message for you. Seattle has been here before. We've experienced this dark history before, and we have no intention of going back there again.
It's hard to say exactly where this is going to end up, but as long as major media and a lot of Americans are unwilling to admit that we are not just dealing with somebody stupid or incompetent or unfair, we're dealing with a full-scale white nationalist, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, who is not just merely doing things that feel right to him. He's doing things directly from a well-established playbook, including using the very specific talking points of the white nationalist movement. So to the untrained ear, to most folks, maybe not the folks who listen to this program, because I talk about white nationalism all the time. But for most folks who don't understand this stuff, who don't know what blood and soil means, who don't understand why the president wouldn't say the name of the park, they don't know what they're dealing with. And it is our job as Americans to educate them on that particular fact. It's important that we get out what the president is doing and why he's doing it. He needs his white nationalist base. He doesn't really have a core necessarily, but he needs the love and adulation of people. This is somebody who grew up without a lot of love and affection from his father. His father was a white nationalist. Actually, Donald Trump's dad actually got arrested at a KKK rally. I guess they're the same thing now. And he needs love from these people. And white nationalism is a thing that he knows. These are the people that he's closest with. And he's very comfortable with this constituency. And he'll fight for this constituency now because it's the only thing that he has left. And he's operating directly from their playbook. And it is our job to point out DACA is being rolled back because Donald Trump is a white nationalist. Our immigration policy is moving in the direction it is because Donald Trump is a white nationalist. Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. Jefferson's Sessions name, his Jefferson and Beauregard, both come from two very important historical figures during the Civil War. And that's Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy, and Beauregard, as in General Beauregard. His name comes directly from racism. And this is his attorney general. This is the guy that's the top law enforcement agency in the nation and is helping Donald Trump make racist law. People need to understand this. And so the takeaway from today's show, and I know I'm getting flustered and I know you can hear it. With respect to DACA, there are things we can do. Look up that article, click on those links, and let's begin helping with our time and our money and our efforts to save the DACA program and to protect these Americans. If we really, really, really want to deport somebody, we can deport the Klan members. And the other thing, understand why the president and the United States Republican Party are doing this. The United States Republican Party just needs the constituency because they need the votes because they're pushing an economic agenda that does not fill, that does not fulfill what the rest of us need. And Donald Trump is operating directly from the white nationalist playbook. And our fellow Americans need to understand that. So let's get out there. Let's get to work on DACA and let's start educating our fellow Americans about why white nationalism, why the Klan, why neo-Nazis are marching in the streets, and let's get them the hell out of there. We're not going to be able to do anything about this until everybody understands what is happening and why it's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire. You can't put out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. And there, in iTunes and Podbean, you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail is just a general statement or inquiry. You can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are The Fire You Can't Put Out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing. And a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin. Signing off, and now that I have woken you up, good morning.